How do you uncover or detect the culture of an organization?
So just simply, Ross, by walking around, I could start to pick up what were the clues about the big patterns that were running this organization.
Siobhan McHale led the culture change at Australia's largest bank with nearly 40,000 employees. She said just walking around the corporate headquarters and the branches, you could easily detect aspects of the culture.
It was very plush, beautiful carpets, light-filled offices, expensive paintings on the walls of the executive suites. And then later that week, I went to the branches. There was paint peeling off the walls. There were threadbare carpets, and there were queues of customers queuing up for service.
The lines, carpet, and paint were visual clues. The low employee engagement scores were her bigger concern. Siobhan shares what she did to help change that company's culture. She's out with the new book where she's compiled lessons for leaders like us on how to manage the culture of our teams to accelerate our results. The book is called The Insider's Guide to Culture Change. This is the class your business school didn't offer. It's the training your employer still hasn't provided. How do leaders like us get people to do what we need them to do so we can grow our results and live the life we desire? That's the question, right? This podcast contains the answers. I am Russ Hill, and welcome to Culture Hacks. Siobhan, you spent most of your career helping leaders manage change, right? Change aspects of their culture. What percentage of organizations do you think don't need changes to their current culture?
Oh, it's a great question. I think in these disruptive times where change is happening so rapidly, culture is never set and forget. I think people sometimes make the assumption that you've got a culture and then that culture continues. But actually, you have to keep going back and examining, Ross, if that culture is meeting your strategic imperatives, because culture and strategy need to go hand in glove. The culture is an enabler of your strategy, and it helps you to achieve your business objectives. So as the business demands change, as the marketplace shifts, you've got to go back and see if your culture is still meeting those business goals. So I would say, it's a tough question to put a percentage on it, because I think all companies really need to be looking at their culture in these disruptive COVID times.
Okay. Let's start with that process. So where do I begin as the leader of a team, as the leader of a corporation, when I start putting together that culture management plan? Where do I start? How do I know what kind of culture I want or need?
Yeah, well, the first place you start is probably not even talking yet about the culture. The first place you start is, what are the business goals? What is my strategy? So if you've got a strategy to be the number one player in the marketplace, if you've got a strategy to grow or to innovate or to be more customer-centric, then you need a culture that matches that. So start with, what are my business goals? Where do I need to go to? What do I need to achieve? And then work backwards from that to determine, therefore, what type of culture is going to meet those business goals.
Okay. And this is really the first phase of what you call the culture disruptor, right? That diagnose stage. Am I right?
Correct.
Looking at what the goals are, what the results are that you want to achieve. And then, so just give us a few maybe steps that are involved in that process. Because I thought in your book, it was real interesting what you laid out is what that ought to look like in practice.
Yeah, so the culture disruptor is my four-step solution to creating a culture that can deliver, grow, and adapt. And notice that I don't say that can create an engaged workforce, because I think really that's a given. Engagement is an important component, but it's not the only component of culture. So you can decide to build a more commercial culture, an innovative culture, a customer-centric culture, a performance-driven culture. And we've got to be able to help managers to create these cultures that can deliver, grow, and adapt. And the first phase of that, you know, is really looking at, what are my business goals? and what is the culture that I have today, and to see the patterns within the organization that are keeping you stuck in the old ways.
So, and a few things that you suggested in the book, for instance, as basic as it sounds, we both know that a lot of leaders don't do enough of that. It's just walking around, right? To listen to some of the themes that you hear. Get into that a little bit. Why the steps that you suggest for getting out into the organization or into the team and figuring out, okay, what's our current culture?
Yeah, well, I had an example of when we turned around. It was a 7-year culture change program at a bank in Australia called ANZ. And my first week at the bank, I spent time in head office and noticed that it was very plush, beautiful carpets, light-filled offices, expensive paintings on the walls of the executive suites. And then later that week, I went to the branches, and a visit to the branches showed that there was paint peeling off the walls, there were cracks on the thing, there was threadbare carpets, and there were queues of customers queuing up for service that they weren't getting. And in fact, the bank had the lowest customer satisfaction rate of any bank in the company. So just simply, Ross, by walking around, I could start to pick up what were the clues about the big patterns that were running this organization, and that was really important in the change process.
In your book, which I should mention the name of, The Insider's Guide to Culture Change, Creating a Workplace That Delivers, Grows, and Adapts. In the first, I don't know how many pages, Siobhan, it's pretty clear that you have some emotion, at least it seemed to me as the reader, about the way leaders are defining culture. You really wanted to reframe that. Is that true? Did I read that accurately?
Yeah, I think culture for me is probably one of those topics that people talk about a lot but don't really fully understand. And it's more about it's how work happens, how the organization functions. And many people, when they examine culture, they think about the behaviors rather than what's happening collectively or the patterns. And for me, it's the difference between the dancers and the dance. So the dancers are the behaviors and what people are doing, but the dance are the patterns or the collective agreements that are in place that people get caught by almost as soon as they join an organization. So we've got to be able to tell the dancers from the dance, the behaviors from the patterns.
Yeah, you typically, when you dig into the topic of culture, you typically get, at least in my experience, a few different camps. You get the values camp that you need to put something up on the wall and state that's our culture. And we'll get more into values in a minute because you have something to say about that too. And then you get others that are behaviors as you're mentioning. And you steered away from both of those. And I found it so interesting you using that word patterns. So walk us through what you mean by that, and maybe in an example or two of what you mean by patterns.
Yeah, so if we go back to the ANZ, the bank in Australia and New Zealand that I talked about, where we introduced a radical turnaround over 7 years that shifted it from the worst performing bank to the highest performing bank in the world. Well, number one on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index and a very high performing bank. What we did right at the beginning was notice that the head office was in role of order giver. They were giving the directions and giving the orders to the branches. And the branches were in role of order taker. And there was a pattern or an agreement between the head office and their branches where they were both pointing the finger at each other and saying, you are to blame for the poor customer service and satisfaction ratings. So this blame pattern of one pointing at the other and blaming them was going around and round, and it was running the company, and actually no change was happening because the energy was taken up in this blame game. So seeing that pattern right at the beginning of the 7-year journey and reframing those roles was a critical part of the change process.
How many patterns or roles do you need to, you know, as I'm getting to work on managing the culture of my team or of our division or the corporation overall, how many patterns should I be looking at? Is there a set number or a set number of roles? When do I know that, okay, I've got enough here to start getting to work on?
Yeah, and this is a critical part of the diagnose phase, because what you're trying to collect is data about what are those big patterns that are no longer working optimally for my team or for my business. So I would probably recommend that you look for the big ones, so potentially three big ones, and probably try and work on shifting those patterns to begin with, and that is plenty. Sometimes people have a list of 20 things. They go away on offsites. They fill up reams of paper on the 20 big things that they're going to do, and very quickly they lose energy because you can't focus on 20 things. So I recommend that you choose no more than three patterns and start to work on those. And you can start to see change relatively quickly. I think that's the other myth about workplace culture, is that it takes years and years to change a culture. In fact, if you reframe the roles, you can see change happening very quickly.
And how do you reframe it? So back, maybe this will take you back to the bank example, but what does that look like? I assume there has to be the people who are playing those roles need to have a conversation together, right? And be able to see themselves in the mirror, like, yeah, okay, I am playing, or we in this position or in this department are playing that role, and then the folks in the other role need to acknowledge it. Walk us through that process.
Yeah, so in the bank, one of the things we did was work to put in a new operating model. So we redefined the operating model of the organization, and for head office, we shifted their role from order givers to support providers. So they were there to provide support to the branches in terms of IT or HR or finance and risk. So their role fundamentally shifted. And then in the operating model, we redefined the role of the branches. There were 700 branches, and we said, you are no longer taking the orders. You are actually in control of your area. So a local CEO was appointed to each local area, and that local CEO was responsible for the P&L, for reducing costs, for staffing, for opening hours, for the culture, for growing, for customer satisfaction. So completely reframe the role of the branches to be the service provider to the customers. And that reframe allowed the people in those different roles to act and behave in a very different way.
How much in that? So the first phase or step is diagnose. Then you're speaking to the second one, which is reframe. How much muscle memory are you battling in that reframe, or even going into the break phase? How much of an issue is that?
Yeah, I think there's always a pull back to the old pattern. The pattern can be incredibly strong. And as a leader or as a manager, you have to watch out for when that old pattern resurfaces again. It can very easily come back. So you're being vigilant to that, because this culture, this pattern does not in place for no reason. It's there for a reason. It has worked for the organization at some level. So it's the way people have learned to be successful in the firm or in your team. So that's why you have to be vigilant, and you have to consolidate your gains is one of the phases in the four phases that I talk about in my book. You've got to make sure you consolidate those early gains. But you also have to make sure you get to what I call a tipping point within 18 months, because if you don't get traction and don't see visible signs of change or reach that tipping point, people can think that the change is just a fad, and they tend to tune out, or they can tend to tune out.
Siobhan, did I read it? There was a part of the book where you talked about measuring culture and measuring progress. And what the way I interpreted what you're saying is that it was important to do that, to pick some metrics. Is it your position that two different organizations, five different organizations may have very different metrics they're looking at to measure both their current culture and progress in the culture? Is that right?
Absolutely. So it's as you can imagine, with the patterns, so seeing the blame game pattern within the ANZ Bank. That's hard to measure. You can't really measure that pattern. But what you can measure, so they were blaming each other for poor customer service, but what you can measure is the outcome of that. So we started to measure customer satisfaction at ANZ, and we started to move from the worst performing bank in the country to the highest performing and one of the best regarded banks in the world. And we did that over 7 years and constantly measuring how we were tracking on that customer satisfaction journey was critical to our progress, because every journey of culture change needs fuel, and some of that fuel is provided by the data that you gather on how you're tracking in terms of your aspiration.
How do you manage the contradictions? Because it seems like in every organization that starts to build what you're advocating, this kind of culture management plan or this plan on what we need to shift in our culture, or what culture we're working toward, how we're going to measure it. It seems like in most organizations, there's one or two executives or vice presidents or whatever level that kind of roll their eyes and are going, yeah, that's all good, but I'm going to be over. Well, you all are doing that culture stuff. I'm going to be over here working on the more important things. You've run into that, I'm sure. How do you manage that, or what's your coaching to leaders on that?
Yeah, I think I get this question a lot, particularly from HR people. How do we convince executives of the need for culture? But what you normally find when you dig underneath that is that the HR professional is speaking to the executive as if culture was just about employee engagement. And in fact, they haven't started with what is this leader trying to achieve in terms of his or her business goals. Once you start talking about what are your business goals, like if you want to grow the company, for example, what you're not doing, if you want to grow the company, you've got to create a growth culture. So in that conversation with the executive, you're talking about here are the steps to create a growth culture. You're not talking about here's an engagement survey, or we're going to put values, or here's a new policy. You really have to have the toolkit, which is one of my passions and why I wrote the book, is how do you create a toolkit that frames culture in a more commercial way. So culture is not just about happy, engaged employees. Of course, that's important, but it is also about other key stakeholders. It's about the shareholders, the customers, the community that is impacted by the organization's activities. So we really need to start walking up to culture's more commercial role. And if you engage in that conversation, then that's what executives are interested in. How can you help me create the culture that can achieve my business goals?
Do you think that in just a couple more questions for you, do you think employee engagement has been over, too much attention has been paid to it? I'm wondering that as I listen to you.
I don't think it's that too much attention has been paid to it, but I think not enough attention has been paid to the other aspects of culture. So one of the big myths about culture that I talk about is that it's purely about employee engagement. So we have conversations about psychological safety, about trust, about communication, about building positive relationships, about inclusion. All of these things are vital, but they're only one aspect of culture. And the other aspects of culture, how do you create more commercial cultures, more customer-centric cultures, more innovative cultures, more adaptive cultures, for example, those conversations are missing in part from my perspective. And that's the conversation we also need to be in.
Gotcha. I mentioned values earlier, corporate values. What do you think about them?
I think corporate values are can be an essential tool, but what I notice is that many people stop the work when they create the values. So they spend tens of thousands of dollars and months of work running workshops, crafting value statements, producing beautiful brochures, and then the work stops and really needs to start then. That's they've done the technical part of the work, the crafting of the values, but the harder part is the more adaptive work of bringing those values to life. And partly it's because people haven't been taught how to do that, which is one of the reasons, again, I'm very passionate about sharing my insider secrets because I've been in charge of culture change in organizations and I know what happens on the inside rather than just flying in and out and advising leaders have actually made culture change happen. And how do you do that? I think we haven't educated our leaders about how they actually make culture change happen after they publish the values.
Yeah, one of the things that I value most about you, Siobhan, and the book is that culture is a relatively hot topic right now. It has been the last few years, right? And so there's a decent amount of material, at least that I come across, that is written. You could tell it's written by somebody who got interested in the topic because it was trending high on, you know, somewhere. Yeah. You've been involved in this work for decades. What started you turning your attention to that? Because when you started thinking about culture, there weren't a lot of books and there wasn't a lot of material and there wasn't a lot of discussion about it. What caused you to go that direction?
Yeah, I started off studying psychology, and as my peers were veering off into clinical psychology, I was much more interested in organizational psychology and how people can be at their best and at their highest in the workplace. And then over the past 30 years, I've just focused on organizational psychology and culture change in particular. And to your point, I noticed, you know, that there weren't a lot of tools, and many of the books that had been written about workplace culture were written by outsiders. So that was an incredibly valuable perspective, you know, so people who were consultants, I had been a consultant myself, or journalists, or academics. And of course, an outsider lens is imperative, but I was missing an insider perspective. How do you actually roll up your sleeves and make the right culture day in, day out within your organization? And that was the perspective I had because I'd spent the last couple of decades as that insider and as the executive in charge of culture change in a series of multinational organizations. So yeah, it's just been my passion for decades, and I had to sort of take a step up and start to share my knowledge and my learnings if I was going to see a difference there. So that's what I've done.
Awesome. What have I not asked you about that you feel passionate about or you think needs to be part of this conversation?
I think the myths about culture, they do abound. And I think one of those myths is that it's HR's job to fix the culture. And that myth became apparent to me when I was working at an infrastructure company and I was having meetings with the executive team, and the CFO was describing in this infrastructure company how the culture really needed to change and they needed to become higher performing and more commercial. And after an hour of talking about this real need for culture change, we shook hands and he said, wishing you the very best, Siobhan, in changing the culture around here.
Good luck with that, right?
Yeah, I realized in that moment that the CFO thought it was my role alone in the HR department to change the culture. So I think one of the first things I would advise people to do is to have that conversation about whose role is it to change the culture, because I think that role sits in multiple parts, but HR has a role as a lead enabler, providing the tools and the processes and the advice to make change happen faster and with less noise. And managers at all levels need to take up their role to change the culture, because culture change is always driven, as you would know, and we've talked about, it's leader-led. You've been talking about that for many years, Russ. So yeah, that's my view on it.
Yeah, you can talk about culture, but if the leader is contradicting the type of culture you need in order to deliver the results, you're not going to make much progress in it. That's been my experience for sure. The book is The Insider's Guide to Culture Change, Creating a Workplace That Delivers, Grows, and Adapts. Siobhan Mikhail is the author. It's been awesome to chat with you for a few minutes about it. Thank you so much for your time, Siobhan.
Thank you, Ross.
Hey, everyone, a couple of quick things. First, you can watch the interview you just listened to. Yeah, the link to watch it on YouTube is in the show notes in whatever podcast app you're listening to right now. You might want to forward that link to friends or colleagues that would find it useful as well. If you haven't subscribed to the podcast, just tap on that subscribe button. You'll get two new great episodes each week. And finally, I want to invite you to our private Facebook group. I spend time there in between the episodes. It's for leaders like us. You can access it by going to theculturehacks.com.